This is the second day of this October 2010 7-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of Japanese Zen master Basui from this is from the 1300s. And our text is a book called Mud and Water. And they have a little bit, the translator, Arthur Braverman, has a little here about whence comes that title, Mud and Water. You remember from yesterday that Basui did not initiate this collection of talks that his disciples made, but he he didn't object to it. He said he didn't know what title to give words put together in such a coarse fashion like mud and water mixed together. And then the translator talks a little bit more about this mud and water. There's the allusion to the Bodhisattva ideal. It's an implicit allusion. The Bodhisattva ideal in which the Bodhisattva treads the muddy waters of this world to liberate ordinary people. And the translator says that Basui also would have been familiar with the koan in the Blue Cliff record, in which the author's introduction, the author describes the clear-eyed man as trudging through mud and water mixing with people. Mud and water mixed together. I couldn't help but think of a little memory fragment when we were with Roshi Kaplow on a pilgrimage through China 25 years ago. We encountered a merchant who would, for a small fee, he would write out your surname, your family name, in Chinese. And Ralph Chapin was with us on the trip, and he stepped up and told them his name is Chapin, and they rendered that as, who knows, something like Chapin, and he wrote those two characters, Che and Pin, and what they mean in Chinese is plain and fancy, properly mixed. Ralph loved that. It's something he felt he himself would take pride in if he ever embodied that principle, and he also felt it reflected this place, Chapin Mill. Plain and fancy, properly mixed. So, a layman asks Basui, what is the true meaning of the statement, outside the sutras, not through words? This is it's obviously not a statement, a formal statement, but it's a phrase that this has always described Zen. The Zen school, that is the meditation school of Buddhism, has always been known as teaching beyond words without reliance on the sutras. So in response, Basui called to him, Koji, which is a term for lay students, Koji. And the guy responded, yes. Basui said, from which teachings did that yes come? And then the layman lowered his head and bowed. The master then said, when you decide to come here, you do so by yourself. When you want to ask a question, you do it by yourself. You don't depend on another, nor do you use the teachings of the Buddha. This mind which directs the self is the essence of the transmission outside the sutras and not through words. It is the pure Zen of the Tathagata. Tathagata refers to the Buddha. Clever worldly statements, the written word, reason and duty, discrimination and understanding cannot reach this Zen. One who looks penetratingly into his true self and does not get ensnared in words, nor stained by the teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs, one who goes beyond the singular road which advances toward enlightenment and does not let cleverness become his downfall, will, for the first time, attain the way. Let's go back and break this down a little bit. He's talking about the pure Zen of the Buddha. And then he says, those things which cannot reach this Zen. The Zen is beyond these things. Clever worldly statements. I think of the clever words of politicians making statements, sound bites that they've crafted to have maximum impact for their benefit. The written word, reason, duty, discrimination, and understanding. Understanding here would mean understanding with our ordinary mind, our discriminating mind. None of these things. Our Zen, the true Zen, is beyond all these things. And he talks about this one who goes beyond the singular road which advances toward enlightenment. Doesn't sound so bad, this road that advances toward enlightenment. But even that, we have to discard from the mind thoughts of making our way along this seeming linear path toward enlightenment. We have to relinquish the thought of enlightenment as a goal in the mind. Because as a thought, it is a terrible obstacle to reaching enlightenment. He goes on, this does not necessarily mean that one who studies the sutras and revels in the words of the Buddhas and patriarchs is a monk of the teaching sects, and one who lacks knowledge of the sutras is a monk of Zen. This doctrine of non-dependence on the sutras is not a way that was first set up by the Buddhas and patriarchs. From the beginning, everyone is complete and perfect. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Buddhas and ordinary people alike are originally the Tathagata. Buddhas, when pluralized like this with an S, Buddhas you can understand as just enlightened ones. The enlightened and the unenlightened alike are originally Buddha. Enlightened. The leg and arm movement of a newborn baby is also the splendid work of its original nature. The bird flying, the hare running, the sun rising, the moon sinking, the wind blowing, the clouds moving, all things which shift and change are due to the spinning of the right Dharma wheel of their own original nature. coughing is also the splendid work of one's original nature. Sneezing, blowing one's nose. And, of course, walking, taking our seat on the tan, moving the dividers, there. The splendid work of our original nature. These things depend neither on the teachings of others nor on the power of words. It is from the spinning of my right Dharma wheel that I am now talking like this, and you are all listening likewise through the splendor of your Buddha nature. The substance of this Buddha nature is like a great burning fire. When you realize this, gain and loss, right and wrong, will be destroyed. Life, death, and nirvana will be yesterday's dream. The countless worlds will be like foam on the sea. The teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs will be like a snowflake over a burning red furnace. Then you will not be restrained by Dharma, nor will you rid yourself of Dharma. You will be like a log thrown into a fire, your whole body ablaze without being aware of the heat. Well, he's really pointing to the tremendous energy that is liberated through getting free of thoughts. Anyone who has been to a 7-day sesshin knows this through their own experience, that there is this continuous mounting of energy that happens as the days go by, simply because we're dwelling in our thoughts less and less and less as the days go by, and we discover tremendous energy. As exemplified by a fire, there's nothing like looking into a fire in a fireplace, a bonfire. It's pure flux, like our nature. It's nothing static. It is pure change. It's dynamism. This is each one of us. Each one of us is potentially a dynamo, a generator. Generator or dynamo is ordinarily defined as a machine that converts mechanical energy into electric energy. In Zazen, we're converting stillness into this great force that can split open the mind and reveal things as they are, the true nature of things. We discover in sesshin that Zazen is not something that gives us energy. We don't need to be given energy. We are energy. That is our body-mind. It's energy. It's just that thoughts keep this energy bound up normally. So when we can detach from our thoughts and just reach single-minded absorption in the practice that we're working on, then we find this release of power that has always been with us. It is us. You will be like a log thrown into a fire, your whole body ablaze without being aware of the heat. This is, to be sure, a deep state of concentration, very, very powerful. He goes on, when you have penetrated the truth in this manner and do not stop where practice and enlightenment show their traces, you will be called a true Zen practitioner. He says, do not stop where practice and enlightenment show the traces. Of course, he means getting beyond this dichotomy, this notion that if we practice, then we'll eventually come to enlightenment. This is a very limited way of understanding this work that we're doing. It's not that enlightenment is just something in the future. It is our nature. It's our nature. This is our enlightened nature that impels us to practice. There's no before or after. Our sitting is the actualization of our enlightened nature. Goes on, there was the Zen master Ejo of Nangaku who excelled in learning the sutras. Before reaching enlightenment, he had an interview with the sixth patriarch, Wei Nong. The sixth patriarch asked, what is it that comes in this manner? It's an opening shot across the bow with this Ejo approaching him. What is it that comes in this manner? Ejo could not answer at that time, but carried his doubt with him for 8 years. His doubt, of course, meaning his questioning, his working on that. What is it? He then came to a realization and went to see the sixth patriarch again. The patriarch said, what is it that comes in this manner? Ejo replied, one word of explanation already misses the mark. The sixth patriarch said, this is still a disease of the mind. Ejo took leave again and once more spent 8 years with this doubt. Finally, having experienced a great awakening, he returned for an interview with the sixth patriarch. The master again asked, what is it that comes in this manner? Ejo replied, it's not that there is no realization, but that it doesn't defile me. And this response, the sixth patriarch immediately accepted. What does he mean? It's not that there is no realization, but that it doesn't defile me. How could realization defile us? Well, it can't. But certainly the notion of realization as something apart from us that we have to try to get to, this is a great stain on the mind. In other words, he realized what another master said, Chinese master, so-called unenlightened people are those who are enlightened the whole day long without knowing it. The one thing that has to be understood through a genuine awakening experience is that we've attained nothing. Can we attain what we've always been? So we could rephrase Ejo's statement here, it's not that there is no realization, but that it is not something that can be attained. And then Basui turns the question to us. If you were asked now, who is it that comes in this manner? How would you reply? And if you couldn't, how would you avoid a beating from the iron staff of the king of hell? This is a part of Buddhist mythology that when we die, we go before the lord of death, Yamaraja. And Yamaraja holds up before us the mirror of our karma, and then we will then be consigned to heaven or hell depending on our karma, how we've lived our life. Yamaraja will be making an appearance next month in our great Jukai ceremony. We build a portrayal of the six realms of unenlightened existence that we traverse on our way to the Buddha Hall for the great Jukai ceremony. But before even entering those six realms of unenlightened existence, we meet up with Yamaraja there at the corner of the walkway, and we are given klesa papers. Klesa means defilement, that are then burned in the ceremony, the Great Jukai ceremony. Basui continues, if this were something which could be grasped through words and sutras, why couldn't the learned Nangaku come up with a word to answer the sixth patriarch? If Nangaku, not yet having attained enlightenment, were to answer in his ignorance, using his common sense and knowledge of the teachings, he might not have attained Satori. Aside from one who instantly penetrates enlightenment with a one-word response, it is rare to find one in this world who, like Nangaku, has directly experienced enlightenment to its core. So, as we can infer from this, if we didn't already know, enlightenment is something that comes in degrees. It's not all or nothing. But so he continues, truly, one who realizes Dharma is to be venerated. He is the master who, for the sake of others, and in accord with their various stages of development, points them directly to their own mind. But there are those who, hearing a word from a teacher, have a great enlightenment in which they lose their body and life. Some, alas, after 3 to 5 days, resolve their doubts, while others take as much as 3 to 5 or even 10 to 20 years before resolving their doubts. We tentatively give this period of doubt the name grappling with one's koan. Though the words may differ and some may realize enlightenment quickly while others take a long time, when realization comes, everyone wakes up to his original nature in its perfection. This realization is not based on words or phrases. There's this word alas here that I don't quite understand, where he's talking about enlightenment. He says, some, alas, after 3 to 5 days resolve their doubts, while others take as much as 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 years. What does that alas mean, that you do it in 3 to 5 days? The only thing I can figure is that if awakening is not grounded in long practice, then it's more tenuous. It's not as solidly anchored in a life of enlightened action. You're more vulnerable when you don't have years of practice behind you. Then you have the exceptions, like the sixth patriarch himself, who came to his initial experience, little Kensho, just without any practice behind him, with just overhearing the words of the Diamond Sutra recited by someone. So this is a very genuine upside to practicing a long time before awakening, is that you really are establishing the ground, or the container that will enable you to function out of that awakening more effectively after attaining it. Someone asked, "The Buddhas and patriarchs use so many methods and means in their teachings. How can there be nothing outside of seeing into your own nature as Buddhahood? Please elaborate on this." Basui responded, "I became a monk in my later years, never learning the sutras. You tell me what dharma there is other than seeing into your own nature as Buddhahood." So just to be clear, we're all on the same page. What distinguished the Zen school from the other schools of Buddhism from the beginning is the simplicity, the focus of just realizing our original nature, and not making too much of reading the sutras, chanting, studying the precepts, and so forth. It's just this going to the root. This is what it is. You could say that these other practices, what's sometimes called secondary practices, are the leaves and the branches of this great tree of the Dharma. But in Zen, the emphasis is on just going to the root and awakening to this mind that has given rise to all these different methods and means and systems and secondary practices. So Basui challenges the questioner to say what dharma there is other than seeing into your own nature. And the questioner goes for it. He says, "According to the sutras, the world-honored one attained Buddhahood after mastering the six perfections. How can this be called seeing into your own nature?" Basui said, "What are the six perfections?" And the questioner was off and running. He said, "They are giving, which is dana, keeping the precepts, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom." And then he explains to the master, "Giving one's possessions to all without discrimination is called dana, or giving. Keeping all the precepts strictly without exception is called shila, or morality. treating animosity and kindness impartially, not getting angry when slandered or beaten, is called kshanti, or patience. I prefer the word forbearance to patience. Forbearance connotes patience in the face of mistreatment or some other adversity. Let's call it forbearance. To move forward in the performance of good deeds without a break in one's journey and to carry out one's vow to completion is called virya, or effort. Sitting meditation is called dhyana. It means sitting in the correct posture in a quiet place and stilling the mind. To learn the sutras and teach extensively and understand completely the important aims of the Dharma without any hindrance is called prajna, which the word prajna can be understood as either wisdom, as we understand it, or knowledge. So what this guy, the questioner, is doing is he's giving the conventional, actually fairly limited understanding of the six paramitas, six perfections. And that gives Basui the chance to offer the other much more profound and broad understanding of these six perfections. He says, all of these bring you fortune for which you can secure a life in the world of humans and heavenly creatures. Performance of these acts is commendable when compared to the acts of evil people. Minds that covet, harm others, are immersed in hatred, are lazy, lack faith, are unstable in thought and action, and ignorant of the way. These evil people who fall into the three evil realms. But one cannot expect to obtain Buddhahood from them, that is, enlightenment. The six perfections which the Buddha practiced are the right dharma of seeing one's Buddha nature. So he's saying that practicing these six perfections as enumerated by the questioner are great. Sure, you do that and your good karma will land you rebirth in one of the higher realms of unenlightened existence, that is, the realms of humans or devas, heavenly creatures. But you're still chained to the wheel of life and death, the wheel of samsara. Whereas, Basui says, the true light of one's original nature lights up 10,000 precious qualities and distributes this light equally in all directions to people in accord with their deeds. This is called dana, or giving. And then second, Buddha nature is pure from the beginning, the master of the six senses, not yet stained by the six pollutants. The six pollutants are the... according to the footnote, this is color and shape, sound, perfume, flavors, touch, and phenomena. These are the... Okay. And then Basui says, the mind and body of one who realizes this will naturally be in harmony. He will not go out of his way to take the appearance of one keeping the precepts. This is called shila, or morality. Okay, three. Since the constancy of Buddha nature doesn't make any formal distinction between self and other, one in harmony with this will neither be angered when chastised nor rejoice when revered. This is called kshanti, or forbearance. Four. Buddha nature is originally possessed of considerable benefit. It brings all merit to its completion, developing myriads of dharmas. It passes on into the future, having no limits. This is called virya, or effort, exertion. 5. Buddha nature is unchanging, detached from all phenomena, goes beyond sects, forsakes rules, doesn't distinguish between saints and ordinary people, and is not confined by words nor colored by values of good and bad. This is called dhyana, or meditation. This, by the way, is a good description of samadhi, a state of deep absorption in one's practice, detached from all phenomena, goes beyond sects. So, no thought of Zen versus other sects. Forsakes rules. When you're in samadhi, there's no thought of rules. Doesn't distinguish between the enlightened and the ordinary people, and is not confined by words, nor colored by values of good and bad. This takes quite an effort for quite a sustained period to reach a zazen that is not colored by judgments of good and bad. And then the last, which is prajna, or wisdom. Buddha nature is clear in itself, lighting up 10,000 human qualities. It's the eyes of saints and ordinary people alike, lighting up the world like the sun and moon. It is the light which sweeps across the past and present, the boundless truth of pure light. This is called prajna, our mind of wisdom, our original mind of wisdom. So the real essence of the Zen school is to get beyond all concepts, all notions in the mind, all divisions, or at least rather to experience this realm of non-discrimination, this realm of that is beyond all form. Thought forms of every kind. Ideas, even the most lofty ideas, images, even the most exalted images of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas. To get beyond means to see that which is beyond all forms, all phenomena. That's what we're doing here, whether we know it or not. This world where we're immersed in phenomena. How do you get beyond phenomena? You can't get away from phenomena. We ourselves, each one of us is a phenomenon. And we also always will have thought forms, thought phenomena arising in the mind. So it's not that we can get away from it, but we can get beyond them. Even in the midst of the thoughts, we can find freedom from thoughts. Even in the midst of feelings and emotions, we can find detachment from feelings and emotions. And even while using words, we can be free of words. Free in each of these cases just means not attached to. Thoughts come up, we don't cling to them. Feelings and emotions come up, of course, all the time. We don't cling to them. We use words, we don't cling to them. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.